It's just a
That's
matter if you
too
want to
fun.
say I have two socks or sock two.
Is it that be sock square, sock two squared or two sock two?
What's like if you're at Costco, you can get sock two squared because of the way it comes in a bundle package.
Yeah, it's like a sock 24.
And guys, it's not 2x the cost either. I'm only talking 1.5x the cost for
a
sock two squared compliant.
Brian, I'm sold. Where do I sign? How do I cut the PO? Do I have to go through a channel partner or can I buy direct? I just want to see Dan's face when I say that.
Act now. Supplies are limited.
Welcome to the Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
The whole compliance space, I mean, number one, I think, Brian, to your point, it's blowing up, right? In a good way. Everybody's
thinking
about it. Can I
put air quotes around the word compliance?
Compliance, yeah.
All right.
Well, that's always the interesting thing. I think that everybody's now looking at supply chain and what we're doing from compliance. But when we look at these reports, how many people actually check the scope of the report? That it's always amazing me that, yes, I could, you know what? I could be ISO 27001 compliant for my house tomorrow, right? Because the scope is going to be my one
this
computer
lid.
Or that lens. Yeah.
That
it's such a critical thing that a lot of companies don't check. Oh, my vendors got this report. They turned it over. We're good. We're compliant.
Well, it's a tick box. It's a tick box exercise. And I think this is one of the, I guess, one of the concerns that I have, as well as one of the things that makes me push back so hard. So I, you know, as a practicing CISO, but also one on the software side, I sit on both sides of this. I have to get quote unquote compliance from my third parties in order to make sure that we are, you know, buying quality products, that the things we do, you know, that there's good practices, et cetera, downstream. But at the same time, I'm barraged and asked by customers for the same things. And it's done, it is done so inconsistently, and it is done in such different ways. And you can tell that many don't read the answers,
right?
And just go, okay, a report came back, a set of questions came back, thanks. It's the ones that come back and ask that I have the most respect for.
Right. Yeah. There's so much to dig into in those.
Yeah.
I remember going through one for a software.
Because there are 900 questions each. There's a lot to dig into.
Well, and then even in the questions themselves, right? That if you think about looking at a SOC 2 report, right? You're going through all the controls, looking for any deficiencies, but then there's other things that you have to pick up on. Start looking at sampling sizes. I remember seeing one from a lower tiered audit firm that when you start to dig into the sample size, you're like, well, there's no way that could actually be representative, that the control is universally applied across the organization.
I looked at two samples, Eric. While before we get too deep, what's a SOC 2? Describe the space a little bit. SOC 2 reports, compliance.
Yeah, so,
what
so
are we
SOC
talking
2,
about?
Yeah. So what we're talking about is the different frameworks that essentially are more public facing, right? So as we think about those frameworks that allow us, that have an auditor base behind them, that you can actually attest to the controls and then use that to provide your customers or whomever that there is a certain level of security built into to the organization. So SOC 1, SOC 2, and all the nuances, because then you got type 1, type 2 that are part of that. All comes in the realm ISO 27001, and certainly, you know, Dan, you have a lot in the government and the space for healthcare and all of that. So, yeah it's all in that public attestation space.
Yeah, yeah, and some of them and different groups do them. The CPAs are the ones that run SOC 2, which I really find interesting. But if you're old enough to remember things like SAS 70s, this is all generations of, this is all iterations of SAS 70 and SSAE 16. So.
And I forgot about those terms. Throwback.
Yeah. All SAS 70s are great because you defined the controls and then somebody else said, yep, they do those, which was really fun and not all that productive.
Yeah.
So Dan, and this is ignorance on my side. When I was talking with a company that does like risk assessments, VCSA work, et cetera, and going through like the people on their team, right? And I'm seeing all their certifications. I'm like, wow, you guys got a lot of guys with CPAs. Excuse me there. I'm like, so do you guys also do a lot of financial auditing? And he goes, well, Brian, for SOC 2, he goes, it was developed by the CPAs. And I was like, touche, mind blown.
The group is called AICPA.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be getting into, so it's the impact of security on
financial controls,
right? So as we think about it, it's kind of in the same realm as we think about Sarbanes-Oxley, that it's anything that could have a material impact to the financials of an organization. It's well thought out. I think the SOC reports, I think, are still fairly good. Again, you just got to know what you're looking for to make sure that it's actually applicable to the way you're doing business with an organization. But,
and I don't mean to throw this back into automotive, but it was like the perfect opportunity to do so. But even when you're doing auditing in the auto side, when they come in and look at your quality or production control, they'd also look at your financials and be like, is this tier 3 or tier 4 supplier financially healthy? You know what I mean?
Oh, totally.
If we're going to buy this one bolt, is this company going to be around for the next 5 years for the life of this vehicle?
That's why we've always, we pull DMB reports. There's actually, I forget, KPMG's got a data feed you can subscribe to that'll actually give you a bunch of the financial information about a bunch of the suppliers. So yeah, that's spot on.
Having the SOC 2 aligned to that too, when you turn it to the financial side, and I can't remember who the person was, Eric, and we talked about this before, I think in one of our text chains, a certain CISO or leader out there that said that he was able to take everything that his team did and put some type of financial number on it for when he was reporting. So there was a business outcome and a financial outcome, whether it was good or bad, right? Every time there was some small incident or this happened, he would tie to, and the people would be like, are you sure you want to report that? He's like, no, it's good. He's like, this is what they want. This is what the board wants to understand. What are the impacts of even the smallest items, right? So when you're doing, I see this more and more with software companies or anybody that's providing some level of IT software service, and not just cybersecurity vendors, right? Could be telco vendors, that companies are now asking that question as they're getting into projects. Are you compliant, and are you SOC 2 compliant? Are you this compliant? And if you're not SOC 2 compliant, who's your security leader and can we talk with them? And there's a lot of small companies out there that are in the software world that are like, well, we're working on that right now. I mean, that's 4 years ago, companies weren't even asking the question. Now, not only are they asking the question, they got to see the information. And this goes even a little bit further, Dan, in the conversations we were having about then how are you doing your risk assessments for your vendors and gathering information.
But man, there's two sides to that. And I appreciate that they're asking, but I wonder how much of that is pro forma and how much of that is actually meaningful discussion. You know, tell me about your security practice. Okay. And you go through these conversations, you go through these responses, and the answers aren't always read or understood by the buyer. And I guess I would expect from, companies I've talked to and worked with, that there'd be a lot more pushback rather than, oh, yeah, thanks for that, and then you never hear from them again. Right. So I guess I suspect more and more just saying, yep, we've got a report from them. We'll look at it when it all goes pear-shaped, not doing real analysis beforehand, which is what makes this me frustrated as somebody who has to provide the stuff to all this in 900 different formats in everybody's little stupid, portal with different login credentials and slightly different nuanced questions from each of them. If you're not going to read it, it ain't worth my time to put it together. Here are some common answers. Have a nice day.
That is true. Well, that's why I think so much of this context matters, right? What is the actual business relationship? Because I know we've seen this, that we've had some major security events. So the snapback was everybody, we got to figure out something. What's the supply chain doing? Well, we like this framework. All right, put it in a spreadsheet, send it over to this company. They'll fill it out. And then, like you said, you get the answers back and then nothing. Or you'll get the other side of that where they do a little bit of automation and we'll respond back that, you know, something about how we develop software, and they'll go, ah, well, you've got some vulnerabilities. Yeah, but we actually don't create any commercially available software. It's just internal report generation, stuff like that. It's missing the context of how business is actually being done. Right. To have a meaningful conversation around actual risk to the enterprise or the business relationship.
We're
not there yet.
Or even worse, there's a box that even with the context, the box can't be checked. And so the buyer goes, we can't buy.
Right.
But hold on. With the context, there's mitigation, there's appropriate mitigation.
Yes.
Or it was never an issue anyway, but I must have a WAF in front of something. Yeah, but it's a locally installed product. You know, something like that kind of completely asinine, discrepancy. And I think the process is getting in the way. No offense, process people. The process is getting in the way of common sense.
Right. Yeah, it's so true. I just had breakfast with somebody the other day, and this was another soapbox moment for me. Because I think we were talking about it in the context of cyber insurance and frameworks. And it pains me how prescriptive we've become as an industry with all of these frameworks that thou shalt have this technology or this technology, rather than let's talk about risk objectives around and allowing for the mitigating controls. And each one of us, if you look at just the three of us, give us one scenario for something we have to secure, we're probably going to come up with 10 different ways to do it.
Right.
None of them neither right or wrong. They're just different. That's the nuance of how we build programs and what's available to us today. But the frameworks miss all of that. Sorry, Ryan.
No, the key word there, the mitigating, right? You could come up with three different ways to peel that onion, right? And each one is mitigating the risk to whatever level you prescribe to it, right? So is
but
one
the insurers
better than the
have
other?
A different level that they're comfortable and a different, and they have comfort in certain methods, and that's why they're prescribing it. We know that 99% of the time, this method will reduce our ability to have our requirement to have to pay by 99%. So we're very happy about this. They all sound like Scooby-Doo villains.
Dan, and I agree with you that, like, if you're filling out all the information, submitting, and the
Brian,
person
your
just
meddling
taking
dog.
It and saying, saying thank
I would have gotten
you.
Away with it, too, if it weren't for you pesky Michiganders. Yeah.
Michiganders. But if you're just filling out the information and someone's putting it to the side, I really truly believe that this is all in its infancy. And what I mean by that is, and again, I'm going back to do an automotive pivot, and I love bringing up DFEMA and PFEMA. But the idea that when you fill out that form, if you go through the entire assembly process from beginning to end, if you were to go through your entire network, right, all your architecture, fill everything out from beginning to end and turn that report into your customer. In the beginning, and how this all kind of prescribed to quality, production control, and risk management of your production to make sure your assembly line wouldn't shut down, a whole team goes in there and they read your report and say, we don't agree with this, we don't agree with this. And then you had to walk them out there and show them what you were doing and why this process is not as critical as they're deeming it, that it's process three down the line that's more critical, and this is why, right? And you show the controls that you put in, right? And the additional visual inspections and this and that. And they're like, gotcha. Okay. We'll sign off.
I'll give you that in the context of a buyer and of a internal team, but I will not agree to that context when it comes to an insurer. Both the buyer and the internal team have the same motives of a theoretically secure product. The insurer has a very different motivator and therefore will look at the process very differently and not necessarily agree with your controls or with your choke points.
You really think they're looking at the process?
No. But I'm saying, insurers look at things insurers have a different intent.
Yes, I would agree.
That is the point.
I think they are more technology checkbox than anybody else.
Right. So they're not gonna give a crap about nuance is the point.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm with you there.
And Dan, one thing I'll say too, and this was a recent conversation where, you know, we had three different people or three different technologies being looked at, and the company actually brought their security leader into the conversation, and And while he was sitting there looking at whatever the technology demo or the console was, watch somebody go in and out without using any type of MFA or single sign-on, and began to ask questions. And that's where it peeled back the onion. And he said, well, do me a favor, just send me your SOC 2 report. And afterwards, I had a great conversation with him. And he was like, you know, he's like, I'm seeing this more and more. He goes, I'm actually asking the question, not are you SOC 2 compliant? Just send me your report. He's like, because there's little things I can look at real quick that would tell me how this was all put together. Like,
right. You
know, well, remember, Brian and everyone, SOC 2 is not a certification scheme. SOC 2 is a reporting scheme. It is not, I have SOC 2, I am SOC 2 compliant. There is no such thing. There is, however, a SOC 2 report that lists out the things that you've done and the thing and the observations made by the you know, by the auditor and the gaps indicated. This is different than ISO 27001, which is a certification scheme. It is a binary. I am certified and therefore I am not. There is not a parallel report. There is, however, a you know, there is, however, a scope document that goes with your ISO document, which can then to Brian, to, sorry, to Eric's, I think, first point of the day, you know, did I certify this lid or did I certify my entire my entire organization? Those should always go together.
Yeah. And again, back to the whole PFEMA, DFEMA. Did I certify this one process?
I'm going to charge you $1 every time you bring those damn things up.
You know, but I,
like, I'd be rich. Recently, what?
Oh, did you just go bare naked ladies? Are you going to sing the rest of the song now?
If I had a million PFEMAs,
the world would be such a better place.
I'd be rich.
I agree with Brian on this one, though. I mean, if you look at think about it, linear versus dimensional, right? PFEMA, DFEMA is dimensional, that looking at the different areas and protecting against the risk of failure. And this gets into, we were going back and forth, Dan, on somebody hit me up on a control that, you have to have DLS, TLS decryption in your web filtering to be secure. Like, okay, no. Does it help? Yes. How much more does it actually break than what it helps? By the way, I've also got an EDR play and some other things sitting on the endpoint that encryption is, the tunnel is already broken down and it's looking at what's going on in the browser. That is a mitigating control. I don't necessarily always have to be in the stream.
Right.
But all of these, the frameworks don't take that into context on all of these different dimensions on the way we can protect against things.
Dan, one day, I swear, the auto industry is going to level up and maybe be the most secure if they can actually look at their security risk management, similar how they look at their production control risk management. I mean, it's amazing because culturally, if you look around the world, whether it's Japanese, Asian auto manufacturers, European, North American, everyone, all the manufacturers are so focused in, right, on their parts per million, right? Can you get to zero PPM, right? Which means zero bad parts per million coming out. So you're putting in all these quality controls. But the other part of that is that you're going to get hit some level of production to make sure that the OE is always able to crank out, say, 1 million F-150s a year, right? Or 20,000 of this truck a month, right? And you have to be prescribed to hit that. And they come through and look at all those controls. And to Eric's point, you may come in and they'll look at this and say, okay, this, you need to have this in place. You're like, no, but I put a visual inspection, I put an extra person, all these other things. But there might be another process that they click on and they say, hey, this one, your rating is so high that your end result, your risk to us, your overall risk score, we can't accept this. You can't supply to us. And the only way to bring that risk score down is to put a piece of technology in place, a camera system or something on the line. And then the management looks at that and says, okay, so the customer's saying they will not agree with us. No matter how much we've argued, we got to put a piece of technology in place. So now you're given budget because everybody agrees all the way up. And it was the same point, Eric, we were trying to make in front of the group of people last week, where it's like, guys, everyone in this room is selling some type of technology that solves a problem, right? Great, right? That might be the best technology for that problem, but it doesn't mean that the people up on stage need to buy every one of your technologies, because right. the way they solve their problems is all different, right? And everyone's internal landscape is different. And the things that you're trying to mitigate and control are different. So then when you go back to these frameworks that people are building and all these different new GRC tools and everything else, it's like, it's morphing right now. And I feel like it's in its infancy. And I know I'm going to keep saying PFEMA and DFEMA, but one of these days.
$2.
Yeah, this is, so this conversation right here, so I'm going to go tangential. This is the concern I have with the evolving SEC requirements as it pertains to boards. This is one of the concerns I have on putting a security practitioner expert on a board, right? There's so many different ways to do things that if you start getting into, and for those that are listening that might be joining boards, this, you have to go in with this mindset that there are multiple ways to do things, but it creates an opportunity for conflict. Well, no, I think you should do it this way. No, this is really, I think, what the best risk posture is for the organization. And there's an opportunity for some tension there. If boards start choosing the wrong personalities to add, to check that box, to give themselves a security expert.
Yeah, no, I think you're right on. And this is another one of those cases of just because you can doesn't mean you should. Just because you're qualified to be on a board and do this doesn't mean you have the right personality, the right business mindedness, the right context for that particular board, the right personality match. I mean, there's all of the same things that go into choosing any board member
right.
that need to go into this as well. And what they don't need, what can't happen is you hire a Mr. Peabody that you stick in the closet and you bring out once a month to say, yes, we're doing great things, Sherman. and then you stick him back in. It needs to be a real meaningful part of the discussion. But you're right. It can absolutely add friction, because it's going to be the foil to business enablement at a board level. To pure business enablement at all costs at the board level. Now I think boards are getting wiser and wiser, and CEOs are getting wiser and wiser when it comes to introducing risk management into their business decision process, especially from a technology perspective, because business is technology today. There's really no such thing as is why we're seeing the fall of the CIO and the integration of this stuff out into business units rather than central IT. But
can I give you an amen on technology is business?
Yeah.
I'll tell you, security, one of the things
is business too.
One of the things that's irking me more and more, and I'm totally going into a soapbox moment here, is when IT practitioners, security practitioners, anybody in the technology space references other departments as the business.
Oh, kill me.
That is such an old mentality.
Yep.
Of being a cost center we got to give it to the geek squad over there and they'll figure something out.
We'll give it back to the business because they're, absolutely.
I go back and I think there was an article years ago that we were throwing around and something, there was a quote, something with the CFO talk to his team we got to go talk to the business. No, right? No. Finance, accounting has always been part of the business.
We got to go talk to unit 7.
Right.
Because they're unit 7 and, yeah, exactly. And as long as we, either technology or security, continue to think of ourselves as different, as separate, we won't be a truly integrated part of the discussion.
True. And this is, kind of bringing you back into the conversation around governance. So, and I know we shared this thought. This is where I think we're at an inflection point in time. Some companies have already picked up on this, where governance and security can be a business differentiator. That it allows you to sell. And Dan, I think I don't know if you want to go into it, but I think you've done some phenomenal things in tying some of your governance pieces to actual sales from the organization. And I think that's really where we need to be. And I think, Brian, we kind of talked about that a little bit in the talk we had at Walsh last week.
Yeah, the idea that, and there is a clear tie to, security is part of every sales cycle. It's part of every, for all the reasons we just talked about, the security questionnaires, the back and forth, the how do you do things, the security won't let me buy until they review, all of those kinds of things that exist in processes, which means that if you're on the sell side, and everybody is selling something to somebody, right? Not, you don't just make things and let them sit there. So everybody's selling something to somebody. The security piece of it is in some industries, it's very clear and easy how it is part of your brand and how and your reputation and the sales cycle. In other cases, it's a little harder to tell, but I think it can always, there's always a way to find a linkage between doing security better and building brand trust and building, right. Building a shorter sales cycle. If you can take 20% off a sales cycle because you've got a set of security documentation that you can present or a clear and concise and transparent method to give to a security officer on the buying side and they can get right through it, or you're using industry standard things, or all of these kinds of things, this is a business enabler because now you're able to start collecting revenue 20% faster or whatever the percentage is for your organization. Right. All of these things, security is business. Nobody buys a thing and doesn't have some discussion about security today. So, build it in. And those metrics, those are dollars. Those are pounds. Those are yen. Those are euros. Those are whatever your currency. It is money.
That is true.
So you're not we're not a cost center, merely a cost center anymore.
Not a cost center. And when we talk about friction, right? Adding in friction, removing friction, right? Like you're trying to remove as much friction as possible so the business can operate at that.
The business?
That cycle. What's that?
The business, or that
your company is trying to operate at.
But
we are trying to operate. If you go back though, every single one of those teams, and I can look at the biggest of sales teams, right? You have a lower level guy that's filling out, putting together a detailed quote on a part. He gives that quotation to his manager. Why? His manager is going to check it. It's the first step of that multi-factor authentication, right? That person could just submit it, put it right through, but we need to double check that all the calculations are right. Because if you put some quote inside there that this material times this weight equals this cost or this price, that's going to stick to every single quote that everybody does in the place. It becomes a standard. And if it's wrong, right, then it's wrong across the entire company. And the customer is going to look at that and say, yeah, I accept that. But there's even more to that. It's not just checking if you're profitable, if it was done correctly. It's making sure that everything was filled out. Then from there, it goes up one step higher. Now that management's looking at it. And there were times where top management might kick something down and say, hey guys, we're not going to do this business. And you're like, why? This makes no sense. This is probably some of the most profitable business we've quoted in a long time. And they say, hey, I get it. It's one program. It's high volume. But the plant that you want to put that into, we have that floor space allocated for a project coming down the road a year and a half from now that's going to be a very large, let's say, transmission. And right. That's going to go into like 15 vehicles over the next 10 years. That's going to be a lifeline for us for a very long time to come. So this one small component, even though it's 20% profit, even though you did your job, you checked everything, we still don't agree. Now, if they just came back to you, said no, and you're like, I can't understand this. And this is another thing where we talk about communication down the chain. The more you make your team involved in how decisions were made and why they were made, right? And you have all those steps and processes put in place, then the more they feel like they are part of the company and the reason right. decisions are being made. Right. But it's also risk management for the business, for the company. Right. But you put those steps in. If you just allowed that sales guy to submit as many quotes as he wanted for whatever's coming through, then the company ends up doing businesses that either A, they didn't plan on doing. They get caught into areas where they're making negative profit because you have no checks, no controls to put in place. You have no risk management of your team. Everything that the company does, every part of that organization has some level of risk management. Even the, like you were saying, the CPAs, the finance team, everybody has double checks. Right. Security are those double checks for a part of the company that is, when I say young, you could be a 100-year-old company, but the fact that you're just moving certain things to the cloud in terms of applications, you're building up this network, you have way more data than you ever consumed before, right? A lot of this is new. So some of the controls that are being put in place, yes, might feel like way more friction because there was no friction there before, but it's because there was no checks and balances. And it's the same for any company that grows. There might've been just one sales guy. Now you have 100, right? You do have to check those things. So right. I think getting everybody to understand and how it's being portrayed that And this is where communication becomes key. And Eric, Dan, we've talked about this a lot. There's people in the security industry or the tech industry that maybe worked for a company for 20 years and were promoted out of necessity, right? Because he was the most important person in the company that did the one thing that nobody else did. That's an extreme amount of tech debt. If you have one person that you've depended on for everything and he fell sick or left, what happens, right? But right. then they don't know how to explain the whys up to management. And I think some of the reporting tools, people believe that they created these GRC tools to find ways for the security teams or the IT teams to, you know, handle what they can't communicate up. But I don't know that some of them are the best example of how to do that.
Well, just like putting Mr. Peabody on the board, you know, we need to do the following technical things, never going to get accepted because that's right. not the language of the board.
Well, to bring two concepts together and what Dan was talking about building trust and Brian, what you're talking about is being transparent throughout the organization and helping others understand the why. I think that's super critical internally, just thinking of it from a leadership context, right? I'm a huge proponent of that bottom-up ideation creates buy-in. Across the team, when people start to understand why things are a certain way, now I can get around it. Otherwise, you're back to that age old, well, information is power. Therefore, if I'm the only one that knows the information, then I'm empowered and I can hold that above. Like those days are behind us, right? The companies and leaders, managers who continue to operate that, I think are
and best.
Are hail. Are going to continue to cease to exist. And that's a critical thing as we think about the security program. And I love what I'm seeing in the space. And I think, Dan, you're working on this right now on creating a trust center. I love this whole concept that now we've moved past and said, hey, I get it. You have a vest, Mr. Customer, Mrs. Customer, I have a vested interest in understanding our security posture. I'm going to show you everything. Here's what it is. This is what you get by all means. I think that is extremely powerful because I'll tell you, we've run into a couple of companies that have come back and said, well, we can't show you our policies because they're proprietary. Really? If we think about a policy statement is a short thou shalt not. If it's containing confidential information, now I have some concerns that maybe you don't understand how to build policies, procedures, standards. And now there's an area of concern there. But by and large, I think the more we move to this implicit trust, I'll show you everything, I think the better off we're all going to be. Yeah.
And keep it up to date regularly and you know, be honest in it. And all of those things, you know, this is how we truly get to what I think the original intention was of things like third-party risk management was really understanding the third parties we're getting in bed with. Yeah, but the reality there is, you know, the more honest you are, the more open you are, it also is good. This is the part about tying this stuff to business value. Now, guess what? When people think about those companies that they want to do work with, they're going to come back to you. So you're building brand value. You're building, you know, reputation, not just because you built a better firewall widget and you have implemented it in a particular way, but because you're a company that they want to do business with, because it's easy to buy, it's comfortable to buy, it's transparent to buy, we know what we're getting, et cetera, along with having a great product or whatever it is that you're buying.
Right. Well, and I want to go back to something Brian was talking about too, on programs that are built on individual people. And just because I've always loved, and I've got to give him the credit, Robert Hill from Citeris always talks about, you know, is it good people doing good things or is it an actual documented repeated process? And I think more and more that we've got to continue to focus on moving our programs above a layer above people, right? People are a critical component of it. You don't do it without people, but a lot of risk is inherent in the process itself and not the technology, not the people. It's how you're going about, whether it's vulnerability management, asset management, any of those things. It's the process that we need to be looking at and making sure that what we build as a program isn't sitting on the shoulders of one individual that, to Brian's point, that if when that person walks, that all of a sudden that process just dies on the vine. Heroics are not scalable. That is not the way to build a program.
Yeah. We are in a marathon. Let's throw some more aphorisms out. Overused aphorisms. We're in a marathon, not a sprint. You can't always be running on adrenaline. It's
the problem with that though, Dan, is it's a marathon, not a sprint, but just like when it came to EVs and timing, and not to go to automotive, but anything that's coming up,
it's
like,
no,
I know it's just so easy. Like we're in Detroit. It's like, hey, we're all going to switch over to this. It's like we got to plan by 2030. We're going to be at 90% electric. Right. And it's like, okay, what was the plan for name the electric company, DT, you name it, to have a grid put in place and for everybody to have the infrastructure at their house? And what about the people that don't live in houses that are in apartment buildings? What about, you know, all the what ifs, right? But it's like, well, the decision's been made, run, right? It goes from, yes, this could be a marathon, what we've talked about 2, 3, 5, 10 years ago to work towards it, to, no, we got to do it now. So I disagree.
I disagree. How did I prepare for a triathlon? It wasn't that someday, some may I'll get a triathlon. When I happen to be ready, I'll enroll in one. I signed up for one and I said, now I have a date. That date is May of 2013 was the first one I did. Okay. Now I work. And from that time, I knew I needed to work on cycling, on running, on swimming, on weight loss, on food intake. You know, there was a whole bunch of componentry, and some of it was a little out of my control. I had to change my house's feeding habits because I was changing. So I think target dates are exactly what you need for these kinds of things.
Here's the problem, Dan. So yes, that was you, but the other 20,000 companies that said, yeah, I want to do that triathlon with Dan too. Somebody go put together what the plan is. And everybody put together the plan and said, this is the things we need to do. And this is the budget we need. And they said, that sounds great. I'm going to have you go back. Can you tweak it just a little bit? And for 5 years, they tweaked a plan, but never started.
But that's their own problem. Those are the people who signed up for the triathlon and never did it. Yes. You know what? I did it.
So many companies that sign up for this prescribed. Okay. So we know this is coming. Right. We know that the government has clearly said this is coming. Yeah. We have a ton of people in our organization that actually sit somewhere in DC and give us feedback. We pay consultants a ton of money to tell us, what do you think is coming? And they say our people are telling us that, well, it might not get signed off on by the end of this year. By 2024, we should all expect this. And they're like, with how much certainty? Like 95%, but either way, it's coming, right? And they're like, okay, perfect. Guys, get that plan back out that you put together last year and the year before. Now we need to even make it more focused, right? And they put it all together, they submit it, and they're like, okay, that's perfect, but there's still not a requirement. There's still not a requirement, right? It's like, we're gonna do it. It's like, yeah, but you do realize that the plan we put together takes 3.5 years to implement. So if we have to be there by next year, we can't get there. And that's what's happened.
But let's come back to business value and look at the one that did. And Tesla is eating every one of their lunches because they said, guess what? We're just going to go do it. We're going to put in our own standard for charging. We're going to put in our own thing. We'll fix it on the way. Guess what? First to market, they're the ones that did it. They're eating everyone else's lunch and will continue to do so. You know, that.
Okay, now you just
be the first to that EV marker. Be the first one out to say, my security looks like this, 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 and this. We've got this compliance. We've got this transparency. You know what? You're going to rule your industry because you're going to be the one they think about.
Now, they might have put some great, great first policies, controls, and standards in place for charging and electric. But if we actually went back to the PFEMA, DFEMA model and said, okay, when you said first to market, they did this, right? We'll fix it on the way. That is true. Yeah. Every one of their large screens, when they said, we're the only ones that can do this, nobody else can. Everyone else said, we've looked at it, but nobody else can make it to this grade of negative 80 and 200 plus Fahrenheit this, right? Like whatever the control is. And they said, well, we don't need that. And a year and a half later, you're replacing every one of your screens.
But right? you know what, Brian? They did it. They took the step. They did it. And they are making money hand over fist. And because it's not just about...
And it's also because they haven't... Okay, that's also because they haven't. This is separate from security.
No, but, no, I think it's exactly parallel. I think it's take the foot off the step, take the foot, the step off the curb, do the stuff you can, do the stuff you know. You may not have the perfect vision, you may not have all the answers about where the industry is heading around an SEC this, or what you need to file there, what your board needs to look like, or what the hell freaking spreadsheet you need to fill out.
Yeah,
but well, you it do comes something. Back
to, if you sit around waiting for 100%, if you sit around and wait for 100% certainty to move in a certain direction, by the time you make that decision, you're behind the eight ball, or it's gone in a completely different direction.
And somebody else has come up behind you and said, "Look, we're doing it." Because you know what? There's always going to be a Tesla, and there's always going to be a GM and a Ford and a Chrysler looking at there, going, "Well, okay, crap. Now we got to catch up."
I do agree with Dan in this sense that I think you're almost into the innovator's dilemma. There was first mover advantage, and we sat back and watched as the traditional automotive makers go, I don't know if this thing's going to play out. We got to run our risk models. Well, let's have a meeting to have a meeting to have a meeting to have a meeting. And Tesla just came in, and that's part of it is the persona of Elon Musk, that right or wrong, we're going to do this. If we fail, fine. And honestly, that's a mentality that resonates with me, though. We cannot be afraid to fail.
And then security, we're so scared of doing it wrong, because if we do it wrong, there's lots on the line. And this is historically, we can have a million successes, but the one failure is the one that gets through, and that's what we have to deal with. So we struggle in this a lot, which is why I'm so adamant about just take the foot off, especially in compliance documentation. Who gives a crap? Just put something out there.
Eric, I do agree with you. The innovator's dilemma, and you are absolutely right. And when you go back and look at history, it was the large OEs that killed the electric vehicle. And he took a big risk, and all the OEs looked at it and said, as long as we keep everybody out, nobody can get in because it costs so much money to get in. And he was able to do it at a speed. And you're right, there was a little bit of sacrifice in quality for other areas outside of, say, the battery, so forth. But by doing so, it forced everybody else to say, okay, now we have to do something.
Right.
And so I will agree with you there, Dan, when it comes to security, right? Like the first person to figure out, I shouldn't say the first person, the company that says, okay, not only are we going to put in the controls, but we're not just going to put band-aids on things and say that we did it. We're going to go back and whether it's journey to the cloud, already in the cloud, look at it, figure out all the processes, controls, and say, hey, we're actually going to do it right. And then this is going to drive business, you know, for the next 10, 20 years. And that's similar to what, you know, when you look at production control lines, right, quality, et cetera, when they looked at the volume, like if we could do this right, we put all the money into it, create these controls, we'll be able to create a well-oiled machine, which is your business. It's your company, right? And if you do those things right, and well, and everyone understands the why, right? It's not just one group doing it, because then nobody else buys in.
It's a culture.
My prediction on this whole space, and going back to just talking about electric vehicles, I actually think we're going to see a replay of copycat players trying to mimic the Tesla model that's going to harken back to TPS. Right, the Toyota production system, that all of a sudden, I think this is why you're starting to see some of the struggling on some of the lesser players. Like, well, Tesla did it this way. Well, how did Tesla do it? Well, if we break it down into these steps, we'll do exactly what they do, rather than recognizing the cultural aspects of the way they're looking at risks and agility. And that is the differentiator and why they're so successful right now.
Which then, if we bring this back to security, unfortunately, we're running out of time here. If you bring this back to security, to developing your own methodologies, to, you know, we are each in our teams and our organizations the most aware of the context and the most aware of the intricacies, and developing the methods that best convey them. I think it's really valuable for us to convey out what it is we do, rather than looking to somebody outside trying to prescribe the questions that they think most effectively narrate our security posture and our control. And if you don't have a message, somebody else is going to ask you to create one. So create the message, be there first with the message. And that will let you set the message, the tone, and the context for it when it comes to risk, when it comes to compliance, when it comes to business value of security in your program, et cetera. Absolutely. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it. Eric, Brian, no more automotive PFEMA and DFEMA for you today. You've had enough. It's like pancakes. You can only have five. And we're really grateful for you, the listener, and you, the viewer. We really love you being here. We really want your feedback, too. Please send us a message, feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. You can find all our past episodes and this episode on iTunes, on your favorite podcast application, and on YouTube. Just search for The Great Security Debate. We're on Twitter, @SecurityDebate. We're not on Mastodon yet, but maybe I'll fix that. If so, we'll post where that is. Our website is www.greatsecuritydebate.net. Thanks again. We'll see you again on the next Great Security Debate.